Hey, everybody. My name's Deb. I'm a real alcoholic. I've been a sober member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous since March 15th, 1987. And right now I live in a little town on the coast of South Carolina. It's called Beaufort, South Carolina. The locals there would be happy that I corrected. I would just want to thank the committee for asking me to come. You know, it is always such an honor and a privilege for me to be asked to do anything in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's interesting for me this year. I haven't been speaking at conferences very long. I think this is my third. And the second one I spoke at was the Young People's, the Missy Paul conference, which was in May here. And I find it very interesting that I get to speak at the Young People's Conference and the Old Timers Roundup in the same year. I'm having an identity crisis. But thank you all very much for having me here. It just absolutely floors me every time my phone rings and somebody asks me if I'll, you know, go someplace far away and talk about my experience as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to do the best that I can to tell you what happened to me, how I got sober, how I worked with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has left me. Because that's the way this thing has worked for me. You know, there are two parts to this thing, and I can't do half of it. You know, I need you all to love me, but I also needed somebody to help me work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and to continue to do that today. I was born and raised in a small blue-collar town in northeast Ohio, right outside of Akron, where this program was founded. My dad worked at a local factory, and he was a member of a union, and all of his brothers and sisters worked at the same factory, and they were all members of the same union. And they had all come from the hills of West Virginia, so I'm really a hillbilly once removed. And and that's okay with me today. I've worked through that. But in the little town that I lived in, everybody worked really hard and then they drank really hard, and there really wasn't a whole lot in between. When I began drinking the way I saw other people in my life drink. There were no social drinkers in my life. Everybody that I watched drink when I was growing up, you know, my father walked in the house after work every day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with a 12-pack under his arm. He drank it by 8 or 9 o'clock. And my sister and I would fight over who got to get in the car with him so that he could drive us down through the drive-thru. They have drive-thru stores there to get another 6-pack so that he could finish that off and so he could go to sleep. And I figured that that was the way people drank, if they drank that stuff in dark little bottles that I wasn't allowed to have any of. And my house was a tough house to grow up in. You know, my father is alcoholic. And my father currently has cirrhosis of the liver, and he's in pretty bad shape. And when I was growing up, I was terrified of everything. I was terrified of my own shadow. I was definitely terrified of you. I was terrified of my peers. I was terrified of not being accepted. I was terrified of just absolutely everything. But you would have never known that looking at me, because I walked tall and I carried a big stick. I was very, very angry my entire life. I was terrified, but I looked angry. And still today, when I get scared, I'll look a little angry. And people say, wow, you look angry. And that is my key to go back and figure out what I'm scared of, because that's how I work. When I was 9 years old, I spent the night with a little girlfriend of mine, and her parents had a full bar in their basement. And all we had ever been told about this alcohol stuff is that we weren't allowed to have anything, that we weren't allowed to have any of it, and that that belonged to the adults. But I knew that it was really important in my house. My parents would get in all kinds of fights. I mean, day after day they were fighting, and it was always about my dad's drinking. And one day there was a specifically big blow-up, because I guess my dad had tried to join one of those animal clubs. And I think this one was the moose. He had already failed at joining the elks. The eagles wouldn't take him, so he was on at the moose. And my mom said, you know, you are not going to be hanging out at those beer joints. And so it was a particularly big fight. And, you know, so I knew that alcohol was really important because everybody gave it a lot of attention. So I just wanted to find out what it was. You know, I didn't start drinking because my dad's an alcoholic. I didn't start drinking necessarily because I was scared. I had my first drink of alcohol because I wanted to know what the stuff was in the dark little bottles and what it would do to me and why I wasn't allowed to have any of it. And so that night when I slept down in that basement with my friend, you know, we started picking bottles off the shelf and we started taking small drinks. And that was a night of firsts for me. It was my first drink, my first drunk, my first blackout, my first hangover the next day. But it was also the first time that I could remember in my short little life that everything was okay. I was okay with you, you were okay with me, and the world made sense. And I didn't feel like everything was so heavy. And I loved that. I didn't know what was wrong with me. But the night that I took that drink, it all got fixed. And I didn't understand it then, and I don't know that I'm 100% can put my arms around it today. But that night, everything was okay. And I remember the next day, even though I was sick and I was thrown up and my head hurt and you know, everybody wanted to know what was wrong with me, and, you know, it seemed like everything was going wrong that next morning. It didn't take me but a minute to remember that feeling of relief and satisfaction that I had the night before. It didn't take me but a minute to remember that I wasn't afraid anymore. And didn't take me but a minute for somebody to remind me how funny I was. And my friend was telling me about all the jokes I was telling. And I got a lot of reinforcement. And I made the decision that day that I was going to drink as much as I could, as often as I could, because I liked what it did to me. I didn't like the way it tasted. There's nothing about alcohol that I liked other than the effect that it gave me. And so every time I drank to get drunk, and that's just the way it went for me. Now, being 9 years old, I didn't get to exactly stop at the corner store on my way home from school and pick up a 12-pack and come home and kick back a few while I'm watching SportsCenter. There were some rules and regulations and some folks who would get a little fussy with me if they found out that I was drinking alcohol, and I knew that because it was the adult drink that I wasn't allowed to have any of. And so what happened was I made that girlfriend my best friend ever. You know, 9-year-olds do that. She's my best friend ever. And it's usually because, you know, you have the same favorite color or something, and that's why they're your best friend ever at 9. She was my best friend ever at 9 because her parents had a bar in their basement and they would let us throw cushions down there and sleep, which meant that every time I spent the night there, I could drink. And so I started spending Friday night there, Saturday night there. Anytime there was a snow day, I would stay there. Anytime there's a holiday, I would stay there. My mom wanted to know, what do they have over there that we don't have? Well, she's just not allowed to stay out places, but, you know, you let me go over there, and so it's all okay. And from that point forward, I started making decisions about the people in my life based on whether or not they could get me close to booze. And that's just the way things went for me. My drinking is not a lot of fun. I didn't do big fun things. I didn't, you know, wreck cars or, you know, flip into ditches or, you know, I certainly didn't get divorced at 10 or 11. I didn't have children to neglect, you know, and didn't have any of that stuff. And so my drinking was really, it was about a little girl who was scared all the time, who looked really, really angry and got relief from drinking. And I just drank as often as I could. And when I was about, I don't know, 13 years old or so, I think it was in the 8th grade, I had made some connections with some people that were older than me. You know, I was 5'9" in kindergarten, so I could pull this off. Just kidding. But I always looked a little bit older than I was, and so I would make these connections, and these people would help me get things to drink. And I started paying very, very dear prices for those drinks when I was 14 and 15 years old. You know, these folks are not folks that I could ever let anybody else know that I knew. They lived on the wrong side of town. They lived in the really small houses that nobody went into. You know, they did things that were completely unacceptable, and I knew that. They were the kind of people, they were morally set up to think that it was okay to buy an adolescent her own bottle of vodka on a daily basis. Those were the kind of people that I spent my time with. And I know that some of you are probably those kind of people at one point in your drinking. Not all of you, thank goodness, but some of you were. And, you know, those people kept me drunk for several years. And by the time I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I used to spend a lot of time when I was brand new in AA trying to qualify, you know, trying to convince all you old-timers out there that I belonged here, because there were some alcoholics, some recovering old-timers, in not in my particular group, but in my area, and they used to say things, you know, like, you know, I've spilt more on my tie than you've drank. And I would say, you know, well, if you didn't spill so much, maybe you'd have gotten here sooner. You know, I mean, just, you know. And, you know, and I was always quick to come back, but there was always that thing in the back of my head. I was trying to work my first step, and there were some people trying to convince me that I didn't belong here. And what I knew was that the last year of my drinking, I was drinking every day. I would go into withdrawal if I didn't have booze. Every decision I made because I needed a drink. I played volleyball games I don't remember. I took entire classes I don't remember. I did everything in my life for a year, and I remember about half of it. And that's the way I drank. And I qualify to be here. I am an alcoholic, and today I'm a recovering alcoholic because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up going to treatment when I was 15 years old because I finally got caught drinking. Now, my parents had gotten divorced when I was 12 because my sister and I, we walked up to my mom one day and we're like, you know, after a particularly violent spree of his, we were like, Ma, can you get us out of here? You know, we're too young, we can't leave. Can you get us out of here? And she said, okay, but it's going to be hard. And we said, bring it on. You know, and my sister had taken to running away a lot. And I said, you know, if you leave, you know, maybe she won't run so much. And so my mom left my dad, and things did get really, really hard. They got hard financially. And it was, God, we really, really struggled. But what that also did, unintentionally, but it was a huge benefit to my drinking, is that it pit my parents against each other. And my father, being a fairly vindictive man who tends to get obsessed and, you know, get a little one-track mind on things, I know nobody in this audience can relate to that, he decided that he was going to make my mother leaving him the most difficult thing she ever did in her entire life. And so my parents have the longest divorce case in Wayne County history. And what that did is it gave us 3 years of utter turmoil and uproar where my mother's focus was out there and she wasn't paying attention to what I was doing. As long as I got straight A's, as long as I played sports, as long as I stayed president of my class, as long as I was in pep club, as long as I was in charge of everything I could be in charge of, nobody was going to look and see how much I was drinking. And I'm not sure how I figured that out, but I just went ahead and started checking boxes. You know, when it was time to cram for that exam to make sure I got an A, I crammed for the exam and made sure I got an A so that I could go out and I could drink. And that's just the way it was. I did everything that I could to make sure that nobody looked too closely at what was going on with me. And my sister helped a lot. I try not to talk about her too much, but my sister is 2 years older than I am. And my sister started using about the same time I started drinking. And my sister, you know, she used to use, I call them dry drugs, you know, marijuana, cocaine, whatever. You know, anything that was dry that she could smoke or snort, she was all over it. And and she would drop acid and go to school. Okay, and she was one of these particularly tragic cases where, you know, every time she used, she got in big trouble. You know, she was the one that was in and out of juvie jail all the time. And she was, I mean, she was just, ugh. And so everybody else's focus was on Diane and how she, you know, we just couldn't figure out what was wrong with her. And I used to sit at the kitchen table with my mom when my sister would run away and she'd be out there using, and we'd just shake our heads. Whew! Boy, isn't she a mess? Wow. Drugs. Can you even imagine? And we would do that, and I'd get my mom all worked up, and she'd get, you know, she wasn't worried already. I'd just feed that fire, and before you know it, she was out driving around the neighborhood, and I was out taking my walk to those dark little houses in that, on the wrong side of town, and I was walking up to the park to get a ride, and I would walk into those places, and I would take my bottle off the shelf where it always was, and I would turn the top, and I would throw the cap away. It's high quality stuff. I would throw that cap away and I would sit with my back against the wall and I would just start to drink. And I was not happy until I was in complete oblivion. And it took a lot of booze. you know, the one thing that I've learned about alcoholism since I've gotten sober is that if you begin to drink really, really young, your body becomes addicted to it very, very fast. And there's a fellow in the fellowship, Burnsby, who talks about, you know, how the disease of alcoholism develops in our bodies. And I began drinking very, very young, and addiction happened very, very fast. And I had a really high tolerance. And I would sit with my back against the wall, and I would watch the things that were going on. And I would say little prayers. And I wasn't really praying to anybody because I didn't believe in God. But I would say little prayers, and I would say, you know, I hope it's not my turn to be in the middle of that trash tonight. Maybe if I just sit here and I'm real quiet and I just drink real quiet, maybe they won't see me. And I did that night after night after night. And I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details about that for a couple of reasons. Well, actually, just for one reason. It's none of y'all's business. But if you are a young female alcoholic out there and you drank the way I drank and you want to talk about that stuff, we can do that afterwards. Well, we're not going to do it here. You guys know what I'm talking about, I think. But those are the kinds of things that happened to me. Those are the kinds of things that I participated in. Those are the kinds of prices that I paid to drink alcohol, because I was too young to buy it, I was too young to drink it legally, and I had to go to those places with those people who had no moral fiber whatsoever and thought that it was okay that a 15-year-old was drinking her own bottle of vodka every day. They didn't think twice about it. And so when I got caught having this party, you see, my mom finally was starting to heal a little bit, and she had the audacity to try to have a date. And the date was going to take her out of town overnight, and, you know, she had made arrangements where I was supposed to stay someplace, and my sister was supposed to stay someplace, and we were supposed to be safe and tended to and all that, and she had no idea that I was drinking. And this is where I make my little Al-Anon comment. My mother had this uncanny ability to believe what she wanted to believe rather than what she knew for a fact was going on, you know? And that is a skill that I found in the long run that I also have. But, you know, and she didn't know that I was drinking, you know, did the quote unquote thing. And so she went out of town, and my sister and I decided that we weren't going anywhere, that we were going to stay at that house. And I was going to invite those people with no moral fiber that I knew, and she would invite the people with no moral fiber that she knew, and we'd have everybody over to our place for a change. And for some reason that night, instead of bringing vodka, which is what I preferred to drink, they brought me a bottle of Jack Daniels, and it didn't go so well. And I was in a drunken stupor by 9 o'clock. And my mom had gotten in a fight with her boyfriend and had come back early. So she walked in at 1:16 a.m. There was a digital clock right there. She walked in at 1:16 a.m. And I was sitting in the corner of her couch, curled up in a fetal position, all of my bodily fluids, and I had been unable to move since 9. And the next morning, she was willing to believe that I wasn't drinking, because she needed to believe that I wasn't drinking. She needed to believe that it not my baby, not my baby. You know, my mom's father was an alcoholic. Her husband was an alcoholic. She was not raising alcoholics, but she was. And so that put a whole chain of events in place that ultimately ended up saving my life. You know, one thing that my mom grounded me. Okay, she didn't ground me for drinking. She grounded me because I wasn't where I was supposed to be. And she grounded me for a week, which doesn't seem like a big punishment for getting caught doing things that I was doing. But what that meant is that if I was grounded, it meant that I couldn't take that walk. I couldn't get in that car at the park. I couldn't go to those little houses in that neighborhood where I never should have been. I couldn't go hang out with those people who scared me. I couldn't pop the top on that bottle. I couldn't sit with my back to the wall. I couldn't hope to God that it wasn't my turn. And I couldn't drink. And that was not an option for me at that point. It was not an option for me to go an entire day without having some alcohol in my system, because my body, it just wouldn't take it. And so my mom and I got into a huge fight the next day about my punishment, and I used to say to her that it would hurt her enough where she would turn her back and just go like this. And he would leave, and he would go get more to drink. I was trying to remember what those things were, because I needed her to turn her back on me and just go like that. And she didn't do it. Thank God she didn't do it. So that meant that I was in a particular jam, because I was already starting to shake a little bit, and I needed a little bit of booze to drink. And And so, you know, things started to get hairy for me, and I started checking under all the beds and in all the cabinets and, you know, the cupboards in the bathroom, and I was just praying to God that somebody left something, because I needed just a little bit to steady myself, and nobody had left a thing. And so I left the house, and it, you know, even though I wasn't supposed to, and things just got ugly. And the next day was Monday, and I was supposed to be in school. And my mom, when I left the house, she called the cops on me. And she said that she had an incorrigible daughter. How dare she call me that? She had an incorrigible daughter, and would they please come and do something with her? Now, I had heard my sister was called incorrigible, and she ended up in juvie jail, so I knew it was getting bad. And so I left the house. I went and grabbed my bottle real fast. I had as much as I could swig down on my walk home, stashed the bottle in the bushes, and went in to face the music. And what they did the next day is they reported my activities to the school. Now, it doesn't sound like a big deal, particularly those of you who are grown. But when you're 15 and your life consists of your crazy house and school, you know, when things come down at school, it's big sometimes. And what they did was they decided that that something had to give. I had to get some help. I had to get honest. They knew that there was something up, that there was more to my story. And so I had heard, now I had been involved in this program called Teen Institute, which is one of those programs where teens go around and they talk at elementary schools and middle schools about alcoholism and how you shouldn't drink and you should just say no and all that kind of stuff. I'd been involved in that program because it looked good for my resume. And so I would go around with a hangover, and I would talk to people about the family dynamics of the disease of alcoholism. And I would talk about, you know, how you shouldn't use drugs and you just shouldn't drink. And so I knew a little bit about the disease of alcoholism. I knew a couple of things. One is that I didn't have it. But two, I knew that if I said I had it, they'd send me to treatment long enough for people to not be mad at me anymore. And so I told them that I was an alcoholic and I needed to go to treatment, and off I went. And that was November of 1986. Now, the 2 days before I went to treatment, it was Thanksgiving night, and the Friday after Thanksgiving, I was due in treatment Saturday morning. I called these people who scared me, these really wonderful people that cared so much about me in my life, and I told them what was going on. I said, you know, they're going to take me to treatment. And it struck me a couple of days into making this deal. It didn't occur to me, and I'm fairly intelligent, so it's a little bit of a head shaker. But it took a few days for it to register that they weren't going to let me drink when I went to treatment. I mean, for some reason, I just didn't get that. Wow, they're not going to let me drink. And, you know, there's a line in the big book talking about, you know, you can't imagine living with alcohol or living without alcohol. You know, you can't imagine drinking every day the way you're drinking, and you certainly can't imagine not drinking every day the way you're drinking. And that was where I was at. You know, I knew that drinking was way, way too important to me. I knew that I needed a certain amount of it. I knew that I was paying really, really, really high price every time I got one of those bottles in my hand. But I also knew that if I didn't have it, I got really sick. And so I needed that. And so anyway, so I go to these people who scare me. And I explain to them, you know, when I go into this facility, they're not going to let me drink anymore. And they're like, ooh, wow, you know, that's not good, because they knew how much I drank. I mean, they were buying it for me. And I said, so here's the deal. You know, I can drink about a fifth of alcohol, but then I pass out and I go through a fairly violent withdrawal the next day. And that was just kind of how I drank. And I said, so here's the deal. Can you guys put together some concoction of some of those little pills that y'all take that might keep me awake so that I could drink just a little bit more? Because I think that I'm near death pretty much every morning. So if I could just get a little bit more in my system, maybe I won't wake up at all. And he said, let me work on that. And on Thanksgiving night, I took that walk. I got picked up in the park. I went to those little dark houses in the wrong side of town with those people who scared me. I walked in, grabbed my bottle, and said, what else do you have? And they gave me a little baggie full of pills. And there was a fairly interesting little, you know, prescription on how I was supposed to take these things so that they wouldn't kill me, but just keep me awake so that I can drink a little bit more, so that I would just not wake up. And it was the red ones and the green ones and then the pink ones and the white ones. And I couldn't keep it all straight. And so like a good alcoholic, I just took them all at once. And I drank, and I came to the next day, and I was at home, and I was confused, and I was sick, and I wasn't real sure what was going on. And so I got myself together the best I could. I had hidden part of a bottle underneath my bed, and I took the walk up to the park, and I got picked up, and I went back to that neighborhood, and I told them it didn't work. And so they got me some more stuff, and I tried it one more time, and I came to in Glen Bay Hospital in downtown Cleveland 3 days later. Which is a treatment center for adolescents. And I came to 3 days later, but I guess I had been wide awake and sharing lots of information. And because of that, about 7 days later on my 10th day, they call the code and all the male counselors are rolling up their sleeves and loosening their ties. And I said, "What's going on?" And they said, "Your sister's here." And I said, "What?" And they said, "Your sister's here. Don't you remember? You gave us all that information about how she was drinking. Your mom thought she needed to be here too." And I thought, oh, this isn't going to be good. Wow. You know, because my sister was as angry as I was. And so my sister came to treatment, and she saw me, and she said, "Don't go to sleep." And I said, "Okay." And I stayed awake just absolutely as long as I could. And I of course had to make a big drama thing out of it. So I had my roommate, we were kind of sleeping in shifts and, keeping each other awake. And we learned as little as we could in treatment. I tried to fix everybody else because I had had this Teen Institute stuff and this SAD stuff and all of these other little groups that I had been in. And so, I took to fixing everybody else. They gave me a little junior counselor's badge. And, I think that was supposed to be some kind of sarcastic point, but it was lost on me. I thought that it was some kind of badge of honor. And they kept me through the holidays, and they let me out January 6th of 1987. And they let my sister out 10 days later. And when I was leaving, I was like, "You forgive me yet?" And she goes, "All right, here's the deal. When you get out, you don't use until I get out." I said, "Okay." And she said, "And call my people and get me my stuff, and we'll relapse together." I said, "All right. Now that's a plan." Okay? Whew, it'd been a long time without a drink. And she was going to completely forgive me if I could do this. So I got out, and I called all those people, and I got my stuff, and I got her stuff, and I went to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got there late, and I sat in the back, and I talked, and I wrote notes, and I got dates. And I would leave before the prayer because I wasn't praying, this God stuff and, heaven forbid this Jesus stuff. I wouldn't have anything of it. And so I would slip out, before the prayer was said, and I would, not talk to anybody unless you were, male and cute. And I was just a general disruption to Alcoholics Anonymous. My sister gets out of treatment. And I'm ready to use. I had been going to a meeting every day for 10 days, and I had had it. I'd had it. You people were old. You didn't talk about anything interesting. I didn't need anything that you had. You didn't know how to have fun. And I didn't know. I knew that I was in the wrong place. And I didn't know why you all kept getting together, because I thought it was a complete waste of time. And my sister got out of treatment, and I was ready to go. And she had had a spiritual experience while she was in treatment for those last 10 days, and she decided that she wanted to stay clean. And I was like, oh, more meetings. And so off we went. I convinced her, though, that the right way to do Alcoholics Anonymous was to get there late, sit in the back, write notes, get dates, be a general disruption. And she went along with that. She was new. And so that's what we did. We'd get there late, sit in the back, write notes, get dates, do all of that stuff. And Mac Shadburn, who's not with us any longer, he had, he used to stand up at every AA meeting, and every meeting he'd stand up and go, "I got 5,372 days." I'd be like, let me guess, tomorrow will be 73 days or 74 days. And, and he used to say that every day, and he'd say, "If you got more years than you got days, you're in trouble." And he came up to me after a meeting, and he said, "We've been talking, and we've decided that you're probably not alcoholic. Have you ever tried to control your drinking?" Control my drinking? what are you talking about? I, you know, take the top off, I throw it away, I drink until it's done. I usually pass out right around that time frame. So it works out pretty well. That's really the only control I had over my drinking. And he said, well, here's the deal. We are tired of you coming into our meetings late, sitting in the back, writing notes, getting dates, keeping people from working on their recovery. You've been a general disruption, and we want you to step down to the nearest bar room and try to have some drinks and try to stop abruptly. He said, and try it more than once if you got to. If you can, I never want to see you again. If you can't, stop abruptly. You belong in these rooms. You're an alcoholic, and you're to come back. And he gave me $5. So I tell my sister, I'm like, hey, I'm giving out money. And so she went up, and she got her $5, and we were, and and he was just so, I mean, he just had that look on his face, like he was sad at what was going on, but he was happy to get rid of us. You know, and now being, am I an old timer? I guess after 15 years, being an old timer, you know, I now understand how he could be sad and kind of happy at the same time, you know, because I've met those people who are general disruptions and get there late and sit in the back and leave early and do all that to-ing and fro-ing, and I just want to say, sit down and shut up. So he gave us money, and he threw me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And on March 14th, 1987, my sister and I took that $5 and we took the little stash that I had put together prior to her getting out of treatment. And we went out to see if we could control my drinking and her drug use. And I had a formula. It was going to be 3 shots and 2 beers. 3 shots, 2 beers. I figured I'd get a warm, safe, fuzzy feeling and I'd stop right there. And I had my 3 shots and 2 beers, and I got my warm, safe, fuzzy feeling, and I thought, not bad. Feel kind of good. It's kind of about where I want to be. I wonder what one more would do. And I had that one more. I said, that's a little bit better than it was, just one more, you know, one ago. So I, you know, and I kept having one more, and one more, and one more. And I ended up going to that neighborhood, to those tiny little houses, filled with those people who scared me, wondering if it was my turn to get in the middle of all that trash again. And I ended up drinking myself to oblivion, coming to the next day, somehow in my house again. And I thought, you can't control your drinking. And I heard Max Shadburn say, if you can't, stop abruptly. You come back. And so I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous on the evening of March 15th, 1987, and I've been walking back into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. And and when you all are clapping, I'd like to think that you're clapping for all those old-timers who put up with me all those years. Because God love them. I'll tell you what. You know, they'd been sober a good long time. They got sober in Akron, Ohio, which is the birthplace of AA. They had a really clear idea of how this thing was supposed to be worked, and by God, I was going to do it just that way, and I would have none of that. And so, you know, they didn't know if they were supposed to parent me, grandparent me, sponsor me. They weren't real sure what to do with me, and I think part of them was hoping that, you know, that I could control my drinking and I'd just go away. You know, but I kept coming back, and when I walked into that meeting on March 15th, 1987, they had had a little powwow, and they had decided that if I did come back, that there was only one woman who was going to sponsor me. They decided who that was. And Matt told me that I couldn't leave that meeting until I had a sponsor. So I walked up to every woman in that room, and there were several women in that room, and I asked each of them, will you sponsor me? And they all said, no, honey. Mm-mm. I said, well, why not? I just can't. It wasn't I won't, it wasn't I have too many, it wasn't I don't have enough time, it wasn't any of that stuff, it was no, I won't. And so I asked another one, and I asked another one, and I asked another one, and all of them said, no, honey, I just won't do that. And finally I got a little miffed, and I'm like, you people aren't supposed to say no to AA. I've been around. You know, you're supposed to say yes when you're asked to do something in this fellowship. And And I had asked every woman in that room except this old woman, and her name was Jane. And I went to leave that meeting. Do we have a Jane who's a bit of a stickler for... Right up there in the front row, right where Jane used to sit. She used to tell me I had to sit up front with slow learners. And I went to leave that meeting that night, and Max said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "Nobody will sponsor me." And he said, "That ain't true." I said, "Yes, it is. I asked every woman in here." And he said, "No, you didn't." And I said, "I'm not asking her." And he said, "Yes, you will." And I said, "No, I won't." He said, "Mm-hmm." And so I walked up to Jane, and I said, "Jane, will you sponsor me?" And she said, "Why should I?" And I thought, well, hell, don't do it if you don't want to do it. But instead of saying that out loud, you know, it's one of the first measurable acts of grace in my life. Instead, I said something to the effect of, "Because I need to be sober, and I don't know how. You do, and somebody's got to teach me how to do this thing." And she just looked at me and she said, "Mm-hmm. You will call me every day. You will read your book." So she gives me this laundry list of things to do, and I'm thinking, nice, this is going to be a lot of work. And so Mac let me leave the meeting because Jane was now my sponsor, and things started to roll from there. They had also decided while I was being a general disruption that if I ever got it together and tried to be a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that it was going to have to be a group project. You know, it's that whole, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. You know, and I lived in a real small town, and I was 15 years old, and I didn't obviously have a driver's license, and I didn't have all these things that would get me back and forth to meetings. And so every day at 7 o'clock in the evening, an old time would roll into my driveway. And they all drove these great big cars. My buddy Bill Long, he's no longer with us either, he used to drive a Ford LTD. I don't know what year it was, but it sure wasn't recent. And that thing would kind of float down the road. And he couldn't see real well, and he was a little short and a little round, and he'd sit up like this. And this is how he'd drive the car. And I would ride to the meetings like this. You know, and I think that was probably my first spiritual experience, realizing that God was helping. But these guys would show up in my driveway, you know, and they'd show up at 7 o'clock every night, because all the meetings up there and that I was going to, they were all 8 o'clock or 8:30 meetings, and they were all in towns that were 30 minutes, 40 minutes, 60 minutes away, and these other little towns. And I would stand on my front porch like this, and I'd stare at them in the car. They'd be sitting in there smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and telling jokes and having a big old time with their windows down, wait, and they would sit there and they would wait until I'd get in that car. And there were a couple times I made them wait over half an hour standing like this. There were a couple times I was standing there so long I couldn't remember why I was standing there. But I wasn't getting in that car. "You can't make me, you can't make me, you can't make me." And they just waited. And one night I made them really late for the 8 o'clock meeting. So they just went to a different town to an 8:30. You know? They just weren't going to let that happen. And something happened. You know, these people, they showed up in my life every day. They loved me when I was absolutely not lovable. Not lovable at all. Okay? When I stopped drinking, I got all that anger back. When I stopped drinking, I was scared of everything. When I stopped drinking, I had so many memories of things that I had seen and things that I had done and things that had happened around me that my head was screaming the entire time. And the only way that I could stop hearing my head screaming is to scream louder than it. And I was not lovable. Except for those who work very hard to see Jesus in everybody. Because they had to look really, really hard to see anything that was worth keeping. And they did that. But these people, they would show up in my driveway every night. And I would think to myself, you know, if I'm just obstinate long enough, one day they're just not going to show up, and then I'll have an excuse for not going to an AA meeting that day. But they never didn't show up. No matter how long I made him wait, no matter how badly I pouted, no matter how many temper tantrums I threw, no matter what I did, they kept showing up. And one day something happened. It's another measurable sign of grace. They pulled in that driveway, and I wanted to hear what joke they were telling from the beginning. And so I got in the car as soon as they pulled in the driveway. And a couple of weeks later, I was out on the steps waiting for them to get there. And then they started letting me play spades with them. Oh, yeah. And then they started letting me hang out with them. Talking was out. I wasn't allowed to talk. But I was allowed to spend as much time with them as I wanted to. And so we spent a lot of hours sitting in donut shops, drinking coffee, eating donuts, and they were talking about the spiritual affairs of the world and their part in them and how God has a hand in everything and that without God, Alcoholics Anonymous would be dead and about how it doesn't matter if you don't want to do the next right thing, you do it anyway. Because nothing is going to ensure that Alcoholics Anonymous is going to be around unless somebody does the next right thing, even when they don't want to do it. And they used to talk about these things in these coffee shops, and I wasn't allowed to talk because I hadn't worked my steps yet. And that was just the way that was. There was no participation in any conversation until you worked your steps because you don't have anything to say. And so I was around just a very, very short while, and I told Jane, you don't tell Jane anything, but I told Jane, I said, I need to get started on these steps. And she said, you think you need to get started on these steps? I said, yes. I had things to say. I had to get these steps worked so I could say things I need to say. And she said, you will not work these steps. And I said, but you're supposed to work the steps. I've been around long enough. No, you got to work these steps. And she said, there are things called the absolutes. You've seen them on placards. She said, you go find out what the four absolutes are. We're going to start there. And I said, well, those aren't the steps. And she said, I don't care. Go find out what the four absolutes are. So I got out a dictionary, and I looked up, love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. Those are the four absolutes. They were left over from the Oxford groups. And so I went to a dictionary, and I looked these things up, and I got definitions of them, and I went running back to Jane, and I'm like, okay. Unselfishness, putting others' needs before your own. Love, to care for. And she goes, well, you know what the dictionary says, but do you know what they are? And I thought, well, no, not really, but man, give the girl a break. And she said, go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and figure out what these things are. And so I went to more meetings than I'd ever gone to before. I started asking people who wouldn't come sit in my driveway to come get me and take me to additional meetings. And I would ask every old timer I saw, can you tell me what the four absolutes are? And they say, well, love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. I say, I know all that. And I know their definitions, but can you tell me what they are? And they just look at me and smile and say, I don't know what you mean. And I did this for a long time. And finally, I walked up to Mac, the one who had tossed me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't talk to him yet because I still had a resentment. And but see, Mac and Jane, they used to fight in discussion meetings, because he'd make a statement, she'd say, that's on page 63, and he'd say, no, it ain't. It's on page 62. And she'd say, no, it ain't. It's on 63, right in the middle. And what they did was they made all of us, we're looking up things in our books to try to figure out if Mac or Jane were going to win. And I went and I asked Mac. I said, Mac, Jane's not going to let me work these steps until I figure out what these absolutes are. Can you tell me what these things are? And he said, well, they're love, honesty, purity, and unselfishness. I said, sir, I know that. But what are they? And he said, sweetie, those are the goals of recovery. He said, those are the things that you're going to put in place of your character defects when you get ready to be a better person. He said, and you're going to spend the rest of your life striving for absolute love, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness. And I said, okay, good to go. So I go running back to Jane, and I'm like, Jane, these are the goals of recovery. I'm going to, and she said, that damn Mac, I knew he'd tell you. And so they challenged me in a lot of different ways to go seek the truth. They challenged me in a lot of ways to want to be a sober member of this fellowship. They challenged me in a lot of ways to want to be better today than I was yesterday. And it was a group effort. Everybody was involved in getting me sober. And I just thank God that everybody was involved in getting me sober. You know, there were amazing people in my life. And I was allowed then to launch into step one. And by the time I was 8 months sober, I had worked all 12 steps. And I started being allowed to have a little part in those conversations at the donut shop. And I realized that the more I talked, the less I learned. That's still true today. The more I talked, the less I learned. But it made me feel a part of, because I had then experienced the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. No longer was I just existing on your love and your kindness, but I was existing on the teachings that you had for me. You all had taken an active interest in saving the life of a 15-year-old alcoholic. Not very many people were willing to sign up for that job, you know, but the people who were around me did. And so when I see people who are standing up in meetings who have 51 years of sobriety, who have 44 years of sobriety, Kelly in the back, who have lots of, you know, these guys I ate dinner with, whew, got a lot of sobriety sitting in the front row. You know, when I meet you guys who have been involved in keeping Alcoholics Anonymous afloat, in keeping the doors open, in keeping groups running, in keeping within the traditions, all I have to say is thank you. Without Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be this fragile flower you now see standing before you. Bad, I know, bad. My life today is a life that is worth living. I've been sober now for 17 years. I'm 33 years old. And I have been, I graduated high school sober. I graduated college sober. I went through my 20s sober, which is very difficult to do. I've gotten married sober. I've gotten divorced sober, but that's a story for another day. I have absolutely had my butt handed to me in recovery. You know, I've had circumstances go on in my life that I thought, how did I get through that? You know, how did I get through that? My grandfather, my mom's dad, he committed suicide when I was about 2.5 years sober. It was in July. It was on July 3rd, and I was getting ready to go off to college in August, and he went down into the basement of their house and he put a rifle in his mouth and he blew his head off. And you know, my mom was out of town and I got the call and I went over to my grandparents' house and they wouldn't let me go in the basement. I said, "Well, what's going on?" And they said, "You know, your grandfather committed suicide." And I said, "I know loneliness like that." Nobody could believe that he had gotten there. And I thought, I know how he got there. He was never willing to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was never willing to treat this disease with the only treatment that has stood the test of time. You know, he was never willing to admit that he was bodily and mentally different from his fellows. He was never willing to give up pride and just say, "I've had it." And, you know, I was able to be of service to my family. And I was able to, I had to do some pretty gross stuff, but I was able to be of service to my family. I was able to save my mother and my aunt from having to do some things that needed done. And I was able to talk my cousin into doing that with me. And he said, "Why are we doing this?" And I said, "Because we need to be of service to our mothers." And he said, "Whatever." He didn't get it. You know, but I knew that I was now going to begin to make really active amends to my mom. You know, as I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to admit that I was an alcoholic because I knew that I could no longer control my drinking. You know, Mac sending me out of Alcoholics Anonymous to try to control my drinking was the absolute first and most important gift that I was ever given in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I can stand before you today and say, I'm a real alcoholic. If you want to read about me, what is it, page 21? Where it talks about a real alcoholic, and somebody better look that up. Okay, but there's a description of the different kinds of drinkers, and I'm in there. And it says, you know, now about the fellow who's been puzzling you. And then it talks about the real alcoholic and the Jekyll and Hyde and the getting tight at all the wrong times and doing all this stuff, you know. And I read that and I thought, check, 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 that's me. And then we got to the God stuff and Jane said, you know, you don't have to pay too much attention to this God stuff. She said, you did borrow mine. I said, what's yours? She said, good orderly direction and I'll give it to you. I said, okay. And so that was my God for a little while. Jane was only alive for the first year and a half of my recovery. And she said when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, she said, I'm going to make a lady out of you if it's the last thing I do. And you know, we were at her funeral and I was at her funeral and I had on a skirt that went all the way down to my knees and I had on a shirt that covered all of my body parts and I had my hair pulled back and I didn't have on very much makeup because they had taken all my products away from me for a long time. And I was there at that funeral, and we walked out, and somebody said, remember when Jane said she was going to make a lady out of you if it was the last thing she did? And I said, yeah. And she looked at me, and she said, that's exactly what happened. It was the last thing she did. You know, and I think about that, and I think, you know, there have been people who have come up to me my entire 17 years in this fellowship, and they would say things to me like, you know, God saved you, so, you know, he must have big plans for you, big plans for you. Because you got sober so young, and you've got all these years of recovery, and you know, and this life ahead of you, and you know, it finally occurred to me not very long ago that what could God have planned for me that is more important than making me fit for service and using me to save the lives of other alcoholics? What could possibly on this earth be any more important than that? If I am used to help one alcoholic recover from alcoholism, getting sober at 15, and staying sober through everything is 100% worth it. You know, God did have special plans for me, but it's the same plan he's got for you. You know, I just get to maybe do a few more years of it. I don't know. You know, but this life that God has given me has absolutely been amazing. I could not have lived the life. I could have not accepted the blessings. I could not honor the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't do the things that I do today. Absolutely couldn't do the things that I do today if I didn't work with other alcoholics. You know? When all else fails, we go to that. You know, God saved me because we are uniquely qualified to save the lives of other alcoholics, and that's it. I don't know. I think I'm running out of things to say. You all have been an absolute great audience. You know, let's have a great conference. Thank you all for having me.